Well, here we are. The upside of down is that the Applied Behavior Analysis International Conference and Convention in Chicago.
Woohoo!
Hey, Kathy.
Hi, Bobby.
How are you?
I'm excited to be in Chicago, which is such a fantastic city. And I feel surrounded by smart people behaving very well.
As it should be.
Okay.
We have some wonderful things planned while we're here. We're going to talk to some really smart people who are specialists in what they do to sort of round out the perspective of the ABA that I do and how it really is exactly the same, but can be applied in so many different ways to so many different aspects of human behavior. So we have a couple of people who we're going to interview.
I'm looking forward to it. You know, in every podcast that we do, I always claim how stupid I am and how uninformed I am and how smart all you guys are and how skeptical I am. But really, I do have a huge respect for the science of it and never fail to be completely fascinated by the stuff that comes up in our conversation. So I'm excited about being an interviewer and seeing what other people from around North America have to say about things.
It is a huge conference. It's a lot of fun. And you came with me to another one.
I have been. I have been before. I remember waiting for you at the first one. This was before we had ever dreamed up the idea of a podcast. And you were late. Your plane was delayed. So I was in the bar and the people all around me were having very strange conversations about odd behavior. And I thought, what a bunch of weirdos. But, my opinion has changed since then.
I think you've come to love us in behavior analysis. We actually have a theme for today.
Okay.
Or for this podcast. And it is, necessity is the mother of invention.
Okay. We need something and the solution isn't there. So we're going to look for the solution.
Right. So we have a problem that isn't being solved and nobody seems to have any good ideas or they're not working. And so we create an intervention or an invention that actually will address the problem. And the person that we're talking to is such an interesting man. His name is Ron Van Houten, and he is a doctor and a professor at Western Michigan University in beautiful Kalamazoo, Michigan. And he has done work all over North America, and I think some in Europe as well, traffic safety and how to decrease the conflicts of near misses and car crashes and people getting hurt and change the behavior of both drivers and pedestrians and people who are traveling from one place to the next with using behavioral analysis.
Okay, I don't know how you do that, but I have to say anything that reduces road rage in downtown Toronto, I am 100% behind.
And I think we all have our moments of anger behind the wheel of a car or as a pedestrian or on our bicycles where there is just been conflict, right? So Ron sets up solutions that engineer the behavior of everybody in those situations to really mitigate the risk. And he's really fascinating. I make it sound boring. He makes it sound interesting. He'll be here in just a few minutes, and we'll just hold for a minute until he arrives.
Great.
Well, it's really pretty straightforward, but they will call human factors, but I would call behavior analysis, looking at studying how we get people to do what we want them to do. And putting various treatments. There were studies done to show that you open up the crosswalk at the signal by moving the stopping back zone. In fact, in places like New York City, every year there were a number of people crushed to death by trucks who stopped right at the crosswalk, right? And as they can't see the pedestrian in front of them, in those days the visibility was quite poor, down straight down over the hood. And so they're up high and they couldn't see the pedestrian. They literally would go, and this pedestrian who was slow crossing at the very end of the signal, senior typically would just be rolled over. And one simple solution is to get them to stop further back and open up the view.
And we, the driver, and we, the pedestrian, we, the regular people, have no idea that you people are.
taking such good care of us.
Thank you.
And there are times when I jaywalk and I cross the street and sometimes after I've got to the other side, I thought to myself, really, Kathy, did you really need to do that? Because sometimes you had to run or it was a little risky. And I think, could you not have walked down to the corner and crossed with the light? Are you in that big a hurry?
Yeah.
And you multiply that, my making that decision by the millions that do it every day. So no wonder we're not all squished.
Exactly. You know, years ago, somebody in the urban design area figured out where we put the sidewalks in. We always put the sidewalks in, and we'd see people making paths through the grass. He said, let's not put the sidewalks in. Let's see where people make the paths. And then we'll put the sidewalks in where the people walk.
Absolutely.
Right?
Isn't that how Manhattan and Boston got their weird streets?
Yeah. So you see where people actually go. And I think, in essence, we know that people don't like the way. They don't like it. Mm-hmm. So one of the things we do is we find out where people want to cross. And that's where we put it. That's where we put good, safe ways to cross, where people actually want to cross or need to cross. The fancy word for that is we have pedestrian generators here, right?
Yeah.
So that's where we want to put a crossing, where the people are crossing. Oftentimes, oh no, people are crossing here, but you know, 150 feet down is a signal. And I had another senior area where that was happening. People wanted to put something really harsh up in the median so people wouldn't want to cross or do something. I said, no, that's horrible. You want to do something like that. You know, just have a something slave to the signal there. And where that's red, they can cross here too. But this is where people are going to cross. And so you know that. And you can try educating. You know, behavioral solutions could work there, some to a certain degree. But look at the, you know, it wasn't 100 feet. Maybe it's about, you know, 350 feet or something. People are reluctant to walk 350 feet out of their way. So if a lot of people are crossing here, if you can find a way for them to cross safely, do it. I mean, that's the way I would look at it.
Yeah.
And
I would think all good functional analysis of behavior is doing that. Find out where the behavior is going and then decide whether you can actually change it, mm-hmm. or whether it's better to go with the behavior and just change some of the circumstances of it to make it work
better. Yeah, but what if the guy driving the car doesn't want to stop where the guy from the street wants to cross?
Yeah. In this situation, which I find interesting, I deal with individuals, obviously, so it's easier for me to do that kind of work and go with the behavior and just measure a person against themselves. You're dealing with populations of people with conflicts, mm-hmm. with differing ideas about what they want. And mostly, they all want efficiency when they're moving from one place to the other. Is that probably true?
No, definitely. I learned that a long time ago. We're doing research on during the first energy crisis, actually it's in Canada, so it was at Mount St. Vincent University at that time. And I wanted to get people not to use the elevator if they didn't need it. Some people need to use the elevator, but everybody's using the elevator rather than going up the stairs. So I tried putting messages about health benefits of using it and energy conservation of using the stairs and health benefits, and gave feedback, which we had used in the past very successfully for other things. So I would publicly post feedback on the percentage of people using the stairs, and we produced no change in behavior whatsoever.
So it was insane.
Yep. So what I did is increase the delay, the wait time on the elevator, by increasing the door delay, how long the doors are open. And we got the largest effect size in an energy conservation study there. Everybody went to the stairs and who could use the stairs. Somebody who needed the elevator, of course, with still physical reasons why I could use the elevator, or they're moving some equipment or you know, a wheelchair or maybe a chronic lung disorder. They could use the elevator. But most of the students had no problems, were now using the stairs and walking. And I think that, yeah, for years people comment, I was the one who did that. But it was healthy. I mean, they benefited from it. Just by increasing their effort, I changed their behavior to the stairs by increasing their time. Time and effort are kind of interchangeable.
Right.
I will trade off a certain amount of effort for wait time. Both are versus. You don't like waiting, increased effort. So if you play with those two things, that's one of the things we used some of our traffic safety solutions inside the vehicle. I did some things for the National Traffic Safety National Traffic Safety Administration in the United States. And we wanted to get people to wear their seatbelts at 100% levels. And I had a way of determining students who aren't wearing their belts reliably. I used a survey, actually, to do this. And it made it look like it was a survey about texting while driving and this kind of thing. It was all about that. All the questions focused on that, except for a couple about you wear your belt, you speak, these other things. I picked people who said they rarely wore their belts. And sure enough, that was effective. They were people. We put them in baseline in the car. We gave them a car for a period of time. And during baseline, we just scored whether they wore their belts. Then we introduced treatment. The treatment was this. You had to explain it to them beforehand. If you were moving the vehicle, right, just a small amount, you could still do that. You don't have to buckle your belt. But if you started to drive the car with 15 miles an hour, the force to drive at any speed went from 2 pounds, a couple of pounds, right, to 35 pounds, 36 pounds. You know, I had to press 36 pounds of force to drive at any speed. Right? You know, that was the pedal resistance on the pedal. And if you buckled, and it came in slow, right? And then if you buckled your belt, that force gradually melted away back to the 2 pounds. And we proved that it was safe. We had to do testing before to do all this. HSIRB.
Because the ding-ding-ding wasn't working?
That's right. Ding-ding. I was involved in getting delayed. I said, I consulted with General Motors and another guy, another behavior analyst, Scott Geller did. And we did two different systems. But basically, we said you need to repeat these reminders because a lot of people don't buckle when they first get in the car and start their car. So with the ding-ding then, it doesn't really matter very much. So you need to let them start to move first to give them the ding-ding-ding because sometimes people want to go out in the winter and they're going to scrape their, turn the car into the heat, get back in. And, you have this ding-ding-ding going while they're scraping their windshield or while they're having a conversation or something in the car before they start to go. So you get the reminder after they go and do a repeat reminder after they're going. And we show them what temporal parameters would work best to get more people to buckle. And they started to put those in their cars. So behavior analysis was actually behind those repeat reminders and how those were designed. Okay, the other thing, though, is this pedal force thing. This gets 100% seatbelt use. 100%. And they like it better than the delay one. The other one I had was a delay. Earlier, I had done a study for them, which now I think GM has an option in their vehicles. I say, they have the brake shift interlock. You have to hit the brake before you can take that apart. Yeah. And they put that in there because they were getting successfully sued because their cars were malfunctioning, going through garages and hitting people in driveways. Because, I went to put my car in gear and I had my foot on the brake and the car just accelerates away. Of course, GM knew, even though they were losing the lawsuits, that that wasn't really how their car worked and that these people had the gas. It was pedal error. They had the foot on the gas rather than the brake. They said, how do we eliminate this liability? And that is, you can't put the car in park, out of park, and you drive unless you have your foot pressed on the brake. So they put in the brake shift interlock. And by the way, that solved that problem.
I always wondered why you had to do that. It's like you witchy people are
banging. I had nothing to do with that. And GM did that on their own because they were getting sued wrongfully, really, and losing in court. You don't have to be.
But there was no way to prove it.
You can lose when you're right.
Oh, of course.
Right? Yeah. It is that way. And so they said, look, this is the way we're going to fix this problem. So they fixed it. And so I used that brake shift and I said, look, when they hit the brake, the shift out of park, that's when they want to drive. So now you give them seatbelt reminder, the chime. And if they don't buckle, they can't shift out until they've had it for 8 seconds. But if they're buckled, they can shift immediately. And if they buckle during the first one or two seconds, they can shift right away. They don't have to wait the full 8 seconds. Well, that increased fleet user seatbelt use from the fleet users usually wear their belts at a lower level than they do in their own cars, their private cars, because they do a lot of short trips sometimes. So they get into a habit of not buckling in the fleet vehicle, right? These are fleet drivers.
Yeah.
Right. So we got big increases in seatbelt use just with the delay, but they didn't like the delay all that much. They it wasn't too bad. The complete interlock, they rejected. They tried to countermeasure. They figure out a way around it. If you tell them you can't ever shift until you buckle your seatbelt, people don't like that. We found that the pedal force, people dislike less because they will, I still can speed it. I can still drive without my seatbelt if I want to. Yeah, but you choose not to because you don't like the force. Yeah. But they don't feel they're being compelled to. They still have some choice involved, so it seems, right? Although if they wear their seatbelt 100%, one could question how much choice they really have.
It really fascinates me about how many of these things that we just have no idea about are so carefully considered and tested and
change human behavior and do the right thing to be safe.
Presumably for the good of humanity.
Absolutely.
To. yeah. evil yeah. behavior analysts. We haven't met them yet, but they're probably downstairs in the bar
trying
right
to,
now.
Everybody would agree. And I think generally, that's what I call the motivating operation. Probably aware of this. One of the cities in Florida, very small city, maybe about 18,000 or so people, were having 1 year 11 children struck. Every year they're having children struck going to and from school. This with safe routes and so on. You know, it's very unusual to have children struck going to in a city like Atlanta, have that many children struck, let alone a very small city. And so this is strange that they're having all these people struck, all these children struck. And one of the things I did the analysis, Florida DOT had to go out and look, and I said, well, hey, one, you don't have a lot of sidewalks in this community. And of course, you can't build sidewalks overnight everywhere, and they didn't have the sidewalks. So we have basically then children crossing the street every which way because there's no sidewalks, walking near the street, bicycling there. There's some sort of safety issues there. And you know, these kids are going to start going back and forth. But I looked and noticed that people were also going fast. They're in a hurry to get to work, drop their kids off. In fact, one crash was that somebody in such a hurry at a drop-off, someone hitting a kid. And one of the students that year was killed in the crash. And so they said, well, we need to do something about this. So this motivating operation. This community wants to do something about it. They don't want this happening, right? There's the MO.
Of course.
And they don't want
the community wants to lose their children.
Exactly. So I said, look, this is what you're going to do. You're going to reduce speeding. Kids are going to and from school to just about zero. So how do we do that? I said, well, it's not really all that hard because you've got the motivating operation. You're going to call all the parents in the schools and other places. You've got meetings before school starts now. Is at the end of the summer now. I said, this is what you're going to do. You're going to educate and say, here's why we're hitting your kids. People are going too fast, and you need to actually be under the speed limit. We're going to enforce it very aggressively. And I got a flyer from them about the kids being hit, but everybody in the community knew it already. I said, you can have this flyer, you can pass it out to people who are speeding. This is what you're going to do. I said, everybody who's just exceeding the speed limit by the smallest number, you're going to pull them over. So we'll be pulling everybody over. I said, that's right. So it's going to be a parking lot.
Extinction.
I said, yeah, it's going to be a parking lot, but only for a few days, and everybody will become a pace car. And I said, and because you prepared them for this, the motivating operation, they're all going to thank you for pulling them over. And nobody's going to complain to the mayor that you have to stop doing this, even though everybody was late for work that first day and so on and so forth. And sure enough, it happened, just as I said. And so we're amazed. People really, really were very contrite, very apologetic. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you what happened. For years, no more children struck. Mm-hmm. Going to and from school. So you said, yeah, at least one would think you can't change behavior like that. Yes, you can, but you have to do it. It's going to be a major thing. And you need to prepare people to accept it. This is what's going to happen, and you need to be accepting of it. And you have to be able to tell me, yes, we want you to do this.
Yes.
Right? Amen. You're going to do this kind of thing. I want that from these people. I want them to accept it. And so you need to prepare them to accept it because they're going to be a little uncomfortable in the beginning. But that will save the lives of the children. If you do that, nobody will speed anymore, right? And that's what they did.
This is the project you went back like a number of years later and took the data.
Oh, that was a yielding one. That was in the city of Gainesville.
Oh, okay.
That was that's a project there. We used public posting, the big feedback signs, and percentage we yield you pedestrian.
Yeah,
we made it a big. Again, we got the community buy-in. We are going to do this as a community. We're going to change the way we do things here.
Yeah.
And so we put all kinds of things in all at once, a whole bunch of things. We had them staged so we could get publicity for each of them on the front page every time we have a wave, we did something.
Yeah.
And yeah, we got yielding from very low levels to very high levels. And people said, well, you know, if we do follow up, we'll probably go back to baseline. And said, mm-hmm. I don't think so, but we couldn't get them to give me a follow up. So on the study. And then years later, 4 years later, I had people at the university there, and they were telling me, you know, the yielding is just awesome here. I can't believe it. And I called, Lisa, you ever go out and try to do any enforcement anymore, pedestrian operations? Oh, we do once in a while, but can't catch anybody. And so I said, something has happened here. Well, we hit a tipping point. We got things up into the high 70s from where they were very low before, and actually got better than the 4 year follow up. We had actually hit a tipping point. It is people, drivers do imitative behavior. If nobody else yields, in a particular, you move to a new community and nobody yields, you start to yield. You see nobody else, everyone else is going. After a while, you start, and they honk their horn, you'll
That's
start to
true.
Do exactly what they're doing.
Right.
You come to a community where nobody yields and everybody's yielding, you start to do what they're doing. If everybody's speeding on a road, you're more inclined to speed. If everyone's running the lights, this is what happens, imitative behavior. Once you hit this tipping point where everybody's doing the right thing, it's self-sustaining.
Yeah.
Right? That becomes a new culture.
So you set
eventually
up a group.
Changing the culture. You're changing the norms and the
right.
culture.
Okay. Set up a group dynamic to either punish or reinforce the right behaviors.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. I would just like to invite this man to Toronto, Ontario, because everybody runs the lights, everybody speeds, nobody yields. That's not maybe not fair, but
yeah, that's a good when you say that. That's a good thing.
One now I have to go back and
see. Let me tell you something. Well, this is a discussion. I love this point because something I discovered is communities that feel they have a major problem typically are the ones who make changes and often have lesser problems than the ones who say we have no problem at all. Some of the worst places that I've seen, we have the highest number of crashes. People say, oh, we don't have a problem. And that's why they have a problem, because nobody recognizes it. Nobody's trying. When people are trying and making efforts, it often makes a difference. That's the bottom line. So if a community that really thinks, you know, I look objectively, and there's a lot of people yielding, but when somebody's hit, they're really outraged how terrible everything is in our community because they want it to be even better. And so they keep the pressure on, keep the community safe because everybody thinks it's important. They have a community that's sort of driver-oriented, doesn't think, for example, about pedestrians. Now we don't have a problem, right? And they do. You look at their numbers. I've seen places with the worst numbers, and they're often the motivation there. There's no motivation to change it. And some of the places who approach me, can you help us, often have relatively good numbers because they're really concerned about walkability, bicycling, or other things.
Well, and
or keep reducing their crashes at intersections with cars. The right. ones that really want to make the changes. Yeah, so it's a funny, kind of almost paradoxical kind of thing. Mm. When there's a lot of interest, usually things are already happening anyway. Where there's no interest, they're blaming the victim kind of mentality. Okay. You probably have very little motivation to do anything. And you see a lot of blaming the victim.
That's right? Why we follow our data.
Yeah.
Data.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you really want to know what's going on in Toronto, just take a look and you know, you can score it easily enough what's going on. You know how to measure behavior, so you can look and see how people measure yielding behavior. People running lights.
Well, I'm measure running
she's light. I guess every city is
speed.
Different,
you
right? It depending.
You can measure. Yeah.
And as we become less dependent on fossil fuels, there's the war, the cyclist versus the pedestrian versus the car in the
right.
city where I live. I think your city is a little
Do
more
Do you have any awareness of like the programs in Vancouver to increase biking and also decrease the risk around biking on our city streets? It's huge, the push. And the tools they're using are really varied. I'm wondering if you...
Those are connected, you know, in a sense. Those two goals. I mean, if people perceive bicycling to be unsafe, a lot of people won't bicycle. So you need to have a perception of safety that should go along with actual safety. So you want to reduce, you want to make it as safe as possible to bicycle. And you want to encourage people to bicycle as much, make it as easy to bicycle as possible.
Right.
Again, getting rid of that interval, the time, the effort, everything, make it as safe as possible. One for fossil fuels, yeah. But even a bigger, it's our health issues.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, consider for a moment that children used to walk to school and bicycle to school, and very often they don't anymore. Well, walking and bicycling, very healthy. That was a big part of the exercise a child got during their day. Look at it, obesity epidemic. What's the cause? Lack of walking, lack of bicycling, too much with your fingers with video things and electronics.
While you're crossing.
So, yeah, that's not very good aerobic exercise, using your fingers on a game. And doing that when you're crossing the street is a very high-risk behavior. So all those things are key, and so on. It's a good thing to promote walking and bicycling as much as possible because it will save on our healthcare costs.
Yeah. Well, this is big.
And better quality of life, an even better reason for everybody, a better quality of life.
Absolutely. And I do notice the more they put in structures and engineering to make the bike, to help the bikers be more safe, the more there are more bikers in the city. And also there seems to be this changing driver behavior in terms of politeness for allowing for biking in those places where we don't have the separate lanes.
So, not Toronto, I would not say.
Well, you know, but as the quantity of bikes has increased, I think that, again, it's you reach a tipping point where they realize, well, we can't beat them and we certainly can't mow them down. So, you know, I better learn to drive with bikes on the roadway.
Yeah.
So,
you're right about that because there's, you know, a tendency, there was years ago, people yelling things out the bicycle in front of the road, this kind of thing. You see a lot less of that, at least where I am from, than you used to. And that's also true in other cities that lived in Canada also, not just the United States. So I think there's a greater acceptance of cycling than there used to be, and a little bit better respect for pedestrians. So I think Canada in general does a little better than the United States in terms of yielding behavior. If I were to say, from my experience, percentage of, there are some U.S. cities where yielding is quite good, and many where it's terrible. True in Canada, too, there are differences. But I think overall, there's higher levels or better levels of performance.
We obey our walk lights.
Yeah.
Yes,
very well.
You guys have to work better now. Yeah. Now you have to get your data together and help the people look both ways before they cross the street again, because everybody stopped doing that.
I tried. You know, I had something. I got it into the manual.
You have a lot of bitterness around traffic safety, Dan.
Oh, listen.
I see.
You've just been waiting to get Ron.
I had no idea that I had a guy that could fix all this.
Such a genius.
I tried something years ago that we collected data on, and it worked. It got in the U.S. manual, but the countdown signal came down at around the same time, and I think there's only so much room up there, so they went with the preference, I think, for the countdown signal. But here was the idea. At the start of the walk, we had eyes come on. The eyes were animated to look left and right.
Yeah.
And just for a brief time to start the walking person. And we found that increased looking. People would just remind you, oh, right. And they would look left and right. So we were actually measuring looking. So we could prompt people to look for vehicles. And we had used signs to do that prior to that. And we also set markings in the roadway to look. In fact, in Britain, they use those.
Well,
there.
Because we're not used to the...
Yeah.
Yeah.
In Britain, they have signs in London, look right on the ground, because we in North America look left first before stepping off the curb.
Yeah.
And of course, the car's coming from the right there. Yeah. And if you habitually look left and don't look right, you'll step right into the moving car, the path of the moving car. So they did that. And oddly enough, Winston Churchill, before World War II, was almost killed in New York City when he was hit. Looking right, stepping off the curb and hit by a car on the left. And he was in pretty serious condition, but he survived the injury. Wow. He did survive the injuries, and so he was almost killed, actually.
Had you been there, you could have changed the course of history.
Well, he did survive.
He did pretty well.
He survived.
I don't know.
So,
clearly, he didn't have a serious brain injury.
But the point is that, reminding people to look and knowing where to look, most people don't know this. If you're crossing clockwise, you have to look in a different sequence than if you're crossing counterclockwise. And when you're crossing in a clockwise direction from any point on the intersection, you're left turning vehicles coming from behind you.
Yeah.
And you're right turning vehicles coming from in front. But if you're going counterclockwise, in a counterclockwise direction, then the right turning vehicle is coming from behind you and the left turning vehicle is coming from ahead. And so it's interesting to note that there's correlations between the direction of the crossing. We did an analysis of that and the probability of being hit by a left and a right turning vehicle, because you have to take more behavior to look for something coming from behind you than something coming from ahead of you.
Always before you cross.
Right. Yeah.
And of course, you've done a piece of equipment, texting. You don't see any of it.
And your earbuds are in, and the light turns green, and so you just assume the pedestrian has it right away. Not you or me, but they. And off they go. They're not paying any attention. They can't hear the traffic. They're texting as they walk. It's frightening. I think it's hard to be a driver, too, in this day and age, because of the lack of attention that other people are paying in your situation.
So is this something we're going to see more of in the future? I love the scramble intersections myself in Europe, and think they might be an answer to that. Because I'm not seeing a lot of engineering in place to help us deal with these issues of knowing where to look as we cross a highly busy intersection. Do you think there will be more in that regard in the future?
I think so. I mean, you mentioned the scramble intersection, but that particular countermeasure involves more delay, And so it tends to be used when there's a lot of pedestrians. Mm-hmm. So I can think of places, Pike's Place in Seattle, or it's probably places you've got a few in Canada. Chinatown is a
Canyon Broadway,
big. You have hundreds of people crossing every, and in New York City, and that's where you see that used. It's not going to be used everywhere because you got to find other countermeasures in some cases and other locations. I think it's getting to know more about the behavior of people and how it works, and trying to match up treatments to particular locations as best you can. Not just from the engineering perspective, but also trying to serve all the users, and also seeing, well, how do we influence user behavior? We want them to do something or not do something. We have to understand something about human behavior there. If we don't, then it's going to, we're working against a wall, right? It's going to be hard. So I think it's kind of a getting together between the traffic engineer and the behavioral psychologist and the human factors expert, basically, to figure out what the best solutions are in a given situation and make them work.
And that sounds expensive.
And you know,
so you must be battling up against
them. They have to provide equipment anyway. Why not engineer the equipment? And you know, you have to paint a crosswalk regularly. Why not engineer it to be more helpful and safe for everyone? I mean,
yeah. Well, we did research to see how that rectangular rapid flashing beacon would work. And we figured out behaviorally how to get it to work, how to get everything to, we did all the data on how effective it is. It's less expensive than a signal. So it's a cost saving there to be able to people to cross the street. I'm working now with the in-street sign. You probably see these thin signs, yield to stop or yield for pedestrians in a crosswalk, depending on if it's a stop or yield law. And they have these. And I've been figuring out that you could use something called the gateway treatment, where you can use several of these. And so drivers have to pass between them at a crosswalk. And when you do that, yielding goes, even on multi-lane roads, well into the high 80s, from maybe 3% to 80-something percent. So we can get very good yielding with that very inexpensive tool. And we noticed that, one, of course, we realized that you're going between things, not only they're looking at them, but they're also slowing some. So, you know, we do the analysis and say, well, how much is the sign message and how much is the help design the message for that one? Or how much is it just the signage? We put just the backing, the reflective yellow-green backing with no message, and it went from 3 to 37%. But we get to 80% when we have the message there. So the message is important, too. But going between these signs seems to be important as well. We're not only seeing slowing, we're seeing looking left and right. This is really cueing them when they cross the crosswalks to look for the people.
So it's a contextual visual cue.
Exactly. And so it's very effective. And we said, okay, but they don't all survive in all placements. So we discovered that there are some tools we can put in there that work almost as well, that have a high survival rate for these signs. And certainly looked at various companies and made different products, which ones survived. So we started to look at that. And that's not really behavioral stuff, but we had to do that too, because we want a solution that's going to, if it doesn't last, then people aren't going to want to use it. They have to maintain it all the time. It's high maintenance costs. So we found some solutions that reduce the maintenance costs for it. And we're doing that project right now. So I think we keep developing new ideas, some of them low-cost ideas. We always think it's going to cost a lot of money to solve a problem. Sometimes you can find some inexpensive solutions. For the car, if you had that, the repeat reminder costs nothing. It's software, okay, for the cars to get people to wear their seatbelts. When you shift out of go to shift out of park, it's software also. Costs you nothing to do that. So a lot of solutions we have are zero cost solutions. And some of the costs inside a vehicle are going way, way down. So
I would contend that most of the time it is a lot less expensive to maintain a solution than it is to maintain a problem. In terms of collateral costs, right? Hospital costs, healthcare costs, when people are getting hit by cars, or even in my line of work, it is so much more costly to maintain the problem than the solution. So why I love behavior analysis, we're all about the solutions.
The thing is that the other things we can do are feedback and reinforcement. So we have a community that's making progress. I think we need to keep assessing and doing assessment. How, where are we now? And convey that information to the community so the community can see where they are.
Absolutely.
And I think that helps too. We need to look at all the tools we have and try to use all of those tools as best we can to keep things rolling, right? To keep them going in the right direction. And reduce speeding with these feedback signs. And you remember this program, Live It Up? I was on that. I was on CTV.
Yeah.
Live It Up.
Yeah, a long time ago. Thank you so much for talking to us. Wasn't he great?
He was great.
My pleasure.
He still is great.
Yeah.
So Ron just left, and my goodness, I found him to be extremely interesting. The first time I talked to him, I heard him speak about this stuff, but it was so nice to have him face-to-face interacting with us and telling us more.
It was ridiculously fascinating. I have to say, you never think when you're driving down the street or you're waiting at the crosswalk about what has gone into the decisions being made at this particular intersection that are there to keep us safe.
Yeah.
All of that is really, really cool to me.
And, you know, the part I really like is that I listen to Ron talk, and everything he does is exactly the same as everything I do, which is why I just think our practice is so technically sound that way. Because even though he's applying it to a variety of groups of people, and he's got a specific goal of limiting those conflicts between those people, you know, he does an analysis of the behavior, just like I do. He uses all the same tools that I do to put in an intervention and create a solution. Keeps it pragmatically going with what works until he hits a tipping point, and then works towards maintaining and generalizing it over time. And it's so interesting that you can look at traffic safety and you can look at a human being and what's stopping them or causing them to go at the wrong time or have conflicts. We can apply the exact same science to it. And it's fun to hear someone else talk about it.
You know, what's fascinating to me was how he was talking about how they look at the data regarding accidents and conflicts, as you guys call them, in certain places. And, you know, when something happens in your hometown, people have been hit by cars crossing the road, and there's a hue and cry from the citizenry saying, we need a stop sign here. Well, we don't actually know if that's true. But a guy like him would go in and look at all the data and would say, yes, a stop sign would be helpful. But he might also say, no, a stop sign is not going to solve the problem of this particular traffic conflict. This would be a better solution.
Right.
So I think that's really cool.
I know. I know. That's why we love behavior analysis.
Well, I'm not going to be able to cross the road or get in my car, or it'll be different for me next time I'm crossing the street.
Yeah.
What about you?
Oh, absolutely. I see different things, like where he's talking about the intersection and how you have to, where you have to look, and how crossing, going different directions can be more dangerous than others. Never had occurred to me.
Never occurred to me.
I know.
We need a t-shirt that says WWRD, what would Ron do? So when we're standing at the corner of Young and Blue or
Canby and Broadway,
which way should we cross first? That'll be safer.
Right.
Thanks
right.
for bringing him in. It was really neat.
It was really fascinating. Absolutely. And yeah, he just goes to prove that necessity is the mother of invention. And also, ABA is the mother of invention. Yay!
It's great.
All right. Bye, Pat.
See you, Bobby.